Welcome back to Spellbound. I'm Julian Smith.
I'm Andrew Rader.
We have an exciting episode for you guys. We are closing up our series on Andrew's book, Beyond the Known, and just in time for me to have finished it.
Oh, you finished it? Oh,
I was cool. I was determined to get through it before we did this episode because it's been way too long. And you know, the way that I read books like this is very slowly because I don't like reading stuff multiple times. So I'd rather just like read it once all the way through and like absorb. I think my retention rate's pretty good is what I'm trying to say. But this book, I just want to say it to anybody who's not read it, and also to you, Andrew, there is nothing like this book that I've ever read. It's like, it's incredible. And Andrew, you should be so proud of it. It was an incredible read. And this is the kind of book that I probably will end up reading multiple times because it's just so dense. There's so much stuff in it. It's crazy.
Yeah, I was just this weekend in the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area, at a number of bookstores and some private events and clubs and things like that, where I was giving talks on the book, and people really liked it. I was almost surprised by the comments I got, because people said that it was really accessible and really readable, even though it was kind of chock full of information, but they expected to pick up something kind of dry or something like that, but it wasn't like that at all. It was really narrative, and they felt like they lost themselves in almost the story of it, which is really good. That's exactly what I was going for, but I wasn't sure how well I achieved that. So yeah, thank you very much.
Yeah, of course. And it's not, what's different about this book is this one is, it's not so much a hop, skip, and a jump through human history, although it kind of is, because you got limited pages you're working with, but it's so detailed. Like, there's so many little side jaunts that it takes where there's just incredible amounts of detail, and like there's so many footnotes. And so I guess what I'm saying is, if you haven't read the book yet and you're looking for something that is historical, but it's a little bit more than a hop, skip, and a jump, and is actually going to go into like detail about, you know, trade routes and like where potatoes, how potatoes got their start in different civilizations and things. It's just like, it's insane. All the little like side jaunts you take. It's great. I love it.
Thank you.
So let's finish this up. This is part three on Beyond the Known, on this podcast. So we've got, the previous two episodes you can go back and listen to. We did them, all within the last like 2 months, I believe. So I don't have the episode numbers in front of me, but if you're just tuning in on this series, definitely check out the first two before you listen to this one. Today, we're going to be covering kind of the part of the book that goes into, like where we kind of colonize space in the future. It's the part of the book that's forward looking. If I had to guess, this is probably the part of the book that most people are like super into. Is that right?
Yeah, I think most people find, I've heard some people who find the history parts the most interesting, but I think a lot of people think the space part is the most interesting. To me, the history stuff is actually kind of more interesting to some extent, just because I do space stuff every day. So it gave me an opportunity to do something different. But the space part is definitely, I think, probably the crowd pleaser. Yeah.
Yeah, this part's a super fun read and so imaginative. Tons of Star Trek references, which shouldn't be a surprise coming from you.
Yeah, the whole section is called Becoming Star Trek. It's basically, I've always thought throughout my life that eventually we're going to become something like Star Trek, maybe not the same technologies, but we're going to become basically spacefaring and be able to travel through space. And I wanted to lay out what I thought that would actually look like. And it's not completely like Star Trek, but it is like Star Trek in some ways, in that it's a very productive future, a future of plenty where we can produce a lot. It comes with, you know, problems that naturally come with that. In the first chapter, I sort of address the problems with the future. AI is one of the big ones I cover, but also potential for climactic change and climate change and, nuclear war and asteroids and that sort of thing. So all the sort of dangers we face in the future, and then talk about sort of the bright parts about the future. And I'm very optimistic by nature. I think that the world is better than it's ever been today, and it will continue to get better, most likely, unless something cataclysmic happens that we're not really expecting. It will probably continue to get better. So yeah, pretty much optimistic. But before we start, I need to ask about those gloves again, because they're kind of giving me a Howard Hughes vibe.
Yeah, Andrew's commenting on my I'm wearing some purple gloves right now. They're super cool moisturizing gloves. My hands get dry in the winter. So I actually discovered this year that I can increase the potency of my hand cream if I wear these for like 30 minutes to an hour when I put my hand cream on. So I do it. I do this. I wear these ridiculous gloves that make me look like a criminal or a surgeon. One somewhere between
Howard
the two.
Howard Hughes. A recluse Howard, who is afraid of germs.
There you go. The perfect middle ground between burglar and surgeon. I do this, and it keeps the hand cream from getting all over stuff, and it lets me just wear lotion one time a day instead of like four times a day. So this is called efficiency. That's what this is.
Very stylish.
I look like I'm about to commit a crime in my own house. So before we dive in, let's take a second to summarize the last two episodes that we did on this book. The book kind of starts with early human history, everything we know about early human life, starting back from Australopithecus and the different Homo species that we know existed and the differences between them. And I'm going to let you take it from here because you're going to do this section way more justice than I can.
Yeah, Homo is a genus, so it's one level above species. Our species, human species, is Homo sapiens, but human, right. The term human is generally used to mean the genus Homo, which includes it could be used for either, actually. So other Homo species, there were 14 throughout history, including Neanderthals, Homo neanderthalis. However, the question is also whether Neanderthals should even be a separate species because we did mate with them and we have Neanderthal DNA in us. So then it's really not necessarily a separate species, right? Anyway, but the whole scientific definition of species is a little dubious anyway. But there's other
this
ones.
This was actually
like
one of my favorite parts of the book was the part. This part going into...
Well, I start with Homo erectus, actually not Australopithecus. I don't actually go back that far, but it's very short, actually, the part I talk about Homo erectus, because I think I talk about him for one paragraph and then say that's not our story. So we start later with Homo sapiens, basically.
Right, right. Yeah, but even...
But one of the really fascinating things about that is for most of human history, there have been multiple species of humans on Earth. Which is crazy, mm-hmm. right? Like, imagine we had actual multiple different species of humans.
Right.
That would be weird. And what would that say about our morality? Would we become more moral because we have sort of more comparisons out there? Or would we probably not? We'd probably just be kind of brutal to them and enslave them or something throughout history and all this kind of thing. So, yeah.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, this is... Now we're kind of getting into some, like, Nietzsche territory. I mean, Nietzsche was really concerned about how morality would fall apart if he was more predicting if people let go of religion how morality would fall apart, which is interesting because he wasn't a super religious guy. Actually, he was the opposite of that. But
throughout history have often thought that they haven't believed in religion, but they thought it was important. I mean, I think Voltaire called it the opiate of the masses. Basically, it's for them. It's for the dumb people who kind of, you know, to keep them in line. But we enlightened folks don't need those kinds of rules, which is really chauvinistic, actually. I mean, I think so many people have proven that.
Incredibly chauvinistic.
It really is. Yeah. So many people have proven, basically, that morality is basically independent of religion. I mean, religion does have rules that sort of teach you, that give guidelines and guidance, some good, some bad. But... it's not like if you take that away, people are going to start murdering each other. We do have an intrinsic sense of morality based effectively on the necessity of living in groups, humans live in groups, and we, you know, have to live in those groups or we don't kill each other as a rule.
Right.
We kill the out-group sometimes, but we have to be able to modify our morality to see everyone as an in-group is what's needed. And that's why I think this actually gets back to one of the reasons I think space exploration is so important, because it's something our whole planet does together, or something beyond our planet, and it sort of is acknowledging that humans now are one in-group. We're one mm-hmm. globalized world, and that's how we should see it.
Yeah. And the fact that we were able to just pause and spend, like, I don't know how many minutes we just spent talking about that one bit that starts your book about the evolution of humans and how many different species within the Homo genus there were. That's just a testament to how again dense this book is, and we don't want to get caught up on this stuff because we actually have a whole other part of the book we're trying to get to, but you know, you start your book by going from the differences between all of those different species, the early human, you know, the upright apes, if you will, species, and then it goes into domestication and the origins of civilization and the first technologies and the beginning of trade and things like that, and we just kind of watch this like progress. And it just walks you all the way up to this point where we are now. And what I love about that is it shows, you know, this book, it's about exploration, but it's also kind of a testament to the willpower of humans, like what we're capable of. Like it's a very hopeful, optimistic book about, you know, not only exploration, but what people are capable of when we come together and work together and do our best. And I think that's what makes the final part of your book so exciting is all the history that we have of doing that and being a collaborative species and just kind of imagining where that's going to take us in the future. So let's spend some time kind of picking apart. You go into so much detail in the future looking part of the book. You talk about terraforming Mars. You talk about the possibility of us creating simulations that are indistinguishable from this one and what we're going to do when those become indistinguishable. And so there's all this imagination in the final part of the book that we should dive into and pick apart. So what are some of the biggest questions that you've had? You've been doing a lot of events around this book, and I'm sure you've been answering a lot of questions from, live crowd members and things like that. So what's like the biggest question you get about the final part of the book that's kind of forward looking?
I guess people still are kind of looking for a rationale why going into space is important. In the book, I cover this in great detail in a couple of chapters, why it's important to go into space. But fundamentally, I think humans are an exploratory species, and it's sort of fulfilling this natural drive that we have. It's channeling our restless energies into something that's positive that helps bring humanity together. And I think that's one of the main reasons. Another is just throughout history, by challenging ourselves, we reach our full potential. Exploration has always acted as one of the most important stimuli to developing technologies. It creates the incentives that drive our technology. So we always set a goal first, and then by learning how to get there, by figuring out how to get there, it generates all these other benefits that we don't necessarily expect. Like when Kennedy said we choose to go to the moon in 1961, we'd just flown people into space, one person into space for 15 minutes, Alan Shepard, the United States had. And so we had no idea how to get to the moon. We had no idea whether we could keep people alive for long periods of time in space. We had no idea if we could navigate to the moon. We had no idea if we could land on the moon. We had no idea if we could take off from the moon or find a way to get back. But within 8 years, humans figured out how to do all of that. And along the way, developed so many technologies that we use today, including, for example, the digital computer, which was developed to navigate the spacecraft to the moon. So all these, you know, you always have this massive technological expansion. It's kind of like the military, in a sense, or war is a huge driver for technology, but of course, war is not something we desire, whereas it's destructive, whereas exploration is something that's productive, that harnesses our restless energies into a productive undertaking that creates the incentives that also drive our technology.
So it's interesting. So people seem kind of skeptical, I guess, about this book's kind of advocacy for going to space and colonizing different planets. Is that like a thing that, is that pushback that you get from people here's a part two to that. Historically speaking, with exploration, there's probably countless examples of people who were against different expeditions and things like that. So is this just something we should expect, that people should be skeptical of new frontiers and things like that?
Oh, people are always going to be. You're never going to build a consensus around things like that. And as you say, in the past, when people have explored, it's not like it's been the whole community of people deciding to do that. It's always a few individuals who drive us forward. And that's always been the way it has been. And it's going to be in the future. I mean, and that's why I think one of the reasons why I think private spaceflight, for example, is so important is because you don't have to build a consensus to do things. You can just, some people want to go, they'll go. And that's great. Mm-hmm. And that benefits all of us. And that's the way it's always worked. And we shouldn't expect to build consensuses around things like this because it's never going to happen. And it never happened in the past and it will never happen in the future. And that's okay.
That's an interesting answer.
Not skepticism. Yeah, it's not skepticism. More just kind of arming themselves with tools to answer questions or kind of further thinking along those lines or something like that. Yeah.
So then do you think that, as somebody who works in, who's working with, directly with space exploration and this is what you do all day, do you think that that the privatization of that is the only way that it's the only way forward? I mean, in the past, the kings and queens have paid for expeditions, like Columbus is a good example. We talked about Columbus a lot on this podcast, and most of his expeditions were funded by other people with money, so that was arguably the public's money. And is that kind of what you're speaking against when you say that that most of the exploration in the future will be done by private programs?
No, absolutely not. I'm actually advocating for exactly the same model that's always been the case, which is a public-private partnership. If you think about all the expeditions throughout history, Columbus is a good example, as you say, or Magellan, pretty much everyone. Mm-hmm. The Dutch East India Company, the British East India Company, the French Mississippi Company, the Portuguese navigators, Captain Cook, all of them were public-private partnerships. Actually, Cook was probably more public than private. But these were all individuals who went out and did things kind of on their own, but they did have government support. And indeed, SpaceX right. has important government support as well. So I think that's kind of more the model, is the government seeks to create these incentives for private companies to go out and achieve. And I think it's important for NASA to try to do things as well. It's important for as many people as possible to actually try to do things, because that's the way we're going to have success, is by having multiple attempts, and some are going to succeed, some are going to fail. That's mm-hmm. the way it's always been. It's always been a public-private partnership. And in an ideal world, the government builds the railways and the private industry figures out how to profit from them. This is always how it's been. In aviation, without government support and research from NACA, which is the predecessor to NASA, or sorry, the agency that came before NASA, they developed the technologies, the airfoils and the cowlings and the aircraft design that private industry could use. In terms of the railroad, steamships, almost every technology was supported by government research and infrastructure, and then developed by private industry.
There's a couple of bits in the book where you talk about the difference in what we Americans, what America used to spend on space programs versus what they spend now. And the points that you raised were that it's just way underfunded now. And so I guess that's why I'm asking this question about your comment about the future of, private exploration. And I was wondering if that had something to do with that, or if it was, because you work, your work is with SpaceX, it's like they get to kind of do whatever they want because they're private, right? So it's not right. Much different structure than NASA. It's not like,
So much of SpaceX's work is directly to either launch commercial satellites or launch NASA spacecraft or launch Air Force spacecraft. So it's not like we get to do whatever we want. We have
right. Well, you have clients
for yeah. most of our missions, and that's where the majority of our funding actually comes from. So, but on the side, obviously, all the Mars activities and mostly those are funded by SpaceX's capital. There is some NASA technological development support. So you're right. Though, I mean, one of the reasons why Elon doesn't want to make SpaceX public is because then we wouldn't have the ability to decide to set priorities and get to Mars. And it right. might possibly jeopardize the goal of getting to Mars. And that's why I think it's sort of really important to have some private space industry, because then the priorities can be set by a small group of people or individuals who want to change the world, who want to make a difference. And that's how it's been through history. And that's a really important stimulus. Whereas with NASA, you may not have to develop a consensus from every citizen in the United States, but you certainly do have to develop a consensus on the political level. You have to have funding approved by the Senate, and you have to have political support behind whatever NASA's mission is decided. And that's a pretty high bar to have consensus at the political level, or at least support at the political level, the majority of support at the political level. So it's we're going to have much greater strides in space if at least some of the priorities are not set by politics, if they're set by individuals.
Okay, that makes sense. All right, so private exploration is probably the future of space exploration anyways.
No, it's mixed. This is what I'm saying. It's both. It's not just private.
You think it's both?
Yeah, it's both. Yeah.
So then if it's both, then and if most of the innovation is happening because of private capital, then A, how is the lack of funding compared to what's been spent historically on space programs? How is that affecting innovation today? And B, what is the solution to that?
Yeah, so it is true that NASA funding was much higher during Apollo. It was maybe six times as high as it is now. I think the level has been pretty consistent for NASA funding since the 1970s at basically 0.5% of the federal budget, or half a penny on the dollar. But to be clear, it's not just private capital. So private space industries are funded to a large degree by government technological development incentives and that sort of thing, which is very important. So I don't want to say it's all private capital, but some of the decision making is private, and I think that's important. But it's hard to say how it's going to pan out exactly, because NASA does have plans to land people on the moon by 2024, and they have this big rocket, SLS, Space Launch System, that is going to launch soon. I think that because all of the activities, especially the big sort of human spaceflight activities by NASA, are tied so strongly to politics, people think that there's more they're more in jeopardy of losing their funding, you know, because if they don't demonstrate realistic advancement in the next 3, 4, 5 years political cycle, they're at risk of being canceled or the priorities change. Mm-hmm. And then the next administration wants to do something different. So unless they constantly receive support from the US political system, they could just die out, and then NASA won't do those things, right? So but it is important to have a strong public sector in space to support private industry and also to attempt to do things on their own, because they can take they can support bigger projects. I mean, NASA is still very well funded compared with a lot of government agencies and compared with even most private industries and stuff like that. So NASA still has a very important role to play.
Of course. We're not trying to discredit NASA.
So the answer is very nuanced. Remember, we had that whole episode on nuance. It's not one or the other. It's both in different ways.
Yeah, I guess the main reason I kind of was hammering in that question is because you did spend so much time in the book, and rightly so, talking about the lack of funding for exploration, you know, in mm-hmm. space. Today compared and if that's where we're going, as your book argues, then that's the question we got to answer, you know?
Well, it is true. I personally believe that space should be funded a lot more. I mean, to give you an example, the amount that we spend on NASA is 1/40th, 1/40 of what we spend on the military. And yeah. To me, you know, space offers at least as much benefit as that. Obviously, funding for the military does provide some kind of technical advancement. It provides technical careers and this kind of thing. But, you know, 40 times as much. That's effectively saying we're spending 40 times as much on fear or prevention of harm from other humans as we are on progressing into the future with humans in space. And to me, that is a little bit lopsided, that kind of prioritization.
Yeah.
So I would love to see, obviously, 2 or 3 or 4 times increase in NASA's budget, and possibly taking money from other places like military spending. But, you know, That may not happen. What I want is irrelevant. I'm not the emperor of the universe. So, and I'm kind of also not holding my breath. I don't necessarily expect to convince people, and that's okay. Yes, I advocate for more funding of space activities, but I don't know that my advocacy is going to make that much difference. And, you know, we set our priorities based on actually kind of the way the human brain works. We're conditioned to respond to fear to a much greater degree than to inspiration and wonder and planning for the future.
Yeah. But Trump saying that he spent $2.5 trillion on beefing up American defense systems during his administration, that's just like, that's so sad to me because, you know, whether or not we needed to spend half of that, like, of course we need to upgrade things and you know, I don't know all the details, but that's an insane amount of money, no matter how you spend it. $2.5 trillion, especially when, like, I don't know what the annual spending on space stuff is, but I know from your book that
it's $18 billion.
$18 billion compared to $2.5 trillion just beefing up our guns, for crying out loud.
Yeah, 500, it's about 200 fold higher. Yeah, it's a bit.
Yeah. The third, I keep saying part three of your book, but it's actually part four. This is part three. That's why I'm getting tripped up. In the podcast, we've got three parts. Your book has four parts. You talk about terraforming Mars, and you're talking about, why don't you talk a little bit about terraforming Mars and the problems with it without giving, you know, obviously the whole part of your book away. Talk a little bit about the obstacles of, like, getting people there, and you're grimacing.
No, I'm not. So terraforming Mars, that is probably a few paragraphs in the chapter, which is becoming spacefaring. So the main kind of point is that there's this middle ground. If we want to become like Star Trek and travel to other stars and have a future where we meet the aliens and that kind of thing, then we have to do what we can with what we have, which is, I think, the lesson of exploration of the past, is people who have done whatever they can, they place themselves at the leading edge of what's possible with their current technology. That's what creates the incentives and the stimulus that improve their technology. So we need to do what we can with what we have in our own solar system before we travel to other stars. So what does that mean? Well, the solar system is a really big place. Most people just memorize the names of the planets and pretty much leave it at there. But there's something like 200 moons in the solar system. There's vastly more real estate in the solar system than there is on our planet. And all the resources that we find on Earth, except for the biological resources, the life, we find everywhere else in our solar system. Earth was started basically as a ball of magma, and all the heavy elements like gold and platinum and iron and all the metals basically sank to the bottom. And the valuable resources, the mineral resources that we mine, actually bombarded Earth later from asteroids. So there's tons of asteroids out there in the solar system that contain more minerals and more resources than we've ever mined in the history of our civilization, just one small asteroid. So there's enough resources and enough real estate in the solar system to support probably hundreds of billions of people. And by sending people out into space, it creates the incentives to learn how to better travel through space. And then we become spacefaring by developing our technologies for transportation of large numbers of people and resources. And that is the necessary step needed to figure out how to live in space for long periods of time and travel through space efficiently that will eventually enable us to travel to other stars. Terraforming Mars is part of that. It's something that is an engineering project of unprecedented scale. So we've never attempted something so difficult before. And it's hard to say how long it would take, but of course the time it would take is completely based on how dedicated we are, how much we pursue that goal. So Mars is the best place that we know of that we could reach today with our present technology. So if you think about traveling into space, you have to think about what's the destination? Why are we traveling into space? Because just like a ship that travels on the ocean, a spaceship, its purpose is to enable people to travel across space and get to the other side. So what is the other side? Right. And the really only good answer to that question in the near term is Mars, because it has the full spectrum of resources that could support a human civilization. And eventually, it could probably be terraformed. Now, Mars has a very thin atmosphere of carbon dioxide, and eventually you would want to make it kind of Earth-like with an oxygen atmosphere, which relies on having plants grow and cyanobacteria and algae to produce the oxygen. But of course, most life couldn't live on Mars today. There is actually some bacteria which probably could live on Mars, on the surface of Mars. But basically, we would have to increase the atmospheric pressure on Mars so that eventually humans could walk around on Mars without a spacesuit and just a simple respirator. And at that point, you'd probably be able to introduce plants, and then eventually there would be enough oxygen to breathe. But that's kind of probably at least decades, probably hundreds of years. I don't know, possibly right. 1,000 years or something like that. It's hard to say exactly. And again, it depends on how hard we try. So the idea is to increase the atmospheric pressure. How do you do that? You make more gas and you create a greenhouse effect, which warms the planet. And as soon as you warm the planet, you get the carbon dioxide melting, because Mars has a lot of dry ice, which is frozen carbon dioxide. It has a lot of frozen water, but it also has a lot of frozen carbon dioxide. And if you do that, you get a greenhouse effect, which traps the sunlight and warms the planet. So basically what we want to do on Mars is what we're trying to avoid on Earth, which is create a runaway greenhouse effect. Yeah. And I think the best way to do that is use chemicals, probably like CFCs and things like that, that have proven to be good in creating greenhouse effects on Earth. So we want to pump the Martian atmosphere full of the chemicals that we're trying to avoid releasing on Earth.
Maybe we can create some technology that teleports all the effects we don't want on Earth to Mars, and then it just prepares it for when we're ready to leave this place.
Yeah, so if we develop teleportation technology, I think we'd be pretty set in a lot of different ways. But
That's true. But is it possible? Is it even possible that we're going to be able to that Mars would be a pleasant place to live? Is that even possible?
Of course it's possible.
Like, would people be able to live there hypothetically but realistically without, living in crazy, like, domes all the time? Like, can they go outside comfortably on Mars in a realistic hypothetical scenario?
Not today, but yeah, that's the whole idea of terraforming, is making so they can. That's basically what terraforming means. Right now, they couldn't go outside without a dome or underground or a spacesuit, at least on the surface. But the idea in the long run is to make it so that they can walk around just with a shirt sleeve and they can breathe the air and everything. So it's absolutely theoretically possible. It's just a matter of the timeline and resources, and we have never done something like that before, but doesn't mean it can't be done. Some people raise the objection that Mars doesn't have a magnetic field, so the sun strips away molecules into space. And this is true. So Mars is leaky. In fact, the reason why it probably did have a thicker atmosphere, and it probably had water on its surface, and it's probably much warmer, but Mars lost its atmosphere because the sun stripped away the molecules and sent them out into space. So, the leak rate is quite small. So if you can replenish the atmosphere faster than it leaks away, then you can maintain Mars in a terraformed state. And that's kind of the tricky part. So you would have to probably continually renew the atmosphere in some way. And then in the long run, you know, if we have a really terraformed Mars, maybe we'd be able to create an artificial magnetic field some way, or create some kind of barriers that would block the worst effects of the sun stripping away the atmosphere, or, I don't know, crash comets into the poles of Mars, which would help renew the atmosphere by releasing a lot of water or vapor or whatever. There's lots of potential ways you could renew the atmosphere. So
we're going to take a quick break, but don't go anywhere. We're coming right back. I promise. All right, so let's talk about another idea from the book, which is traveling to different stars. And let's talk about why you think this is important and what some of the challenges are.
Well, in the long run, I think humans will either destroy themselves or have to eventually travel to other stars. I mean, the sun will consume Earth and eventually the entire solar system within a few billion years. But it's a long time. But in the very long run, obviously, we have to travel to other stars. And I think our just natural human drive will eventually take us to other stars. But as I say, I think that we have a future of expanding throughout the solar system first, and then becoming comfortable with long-duration spaceflight, and then eventually figuring out a way to send a ship, probably more kind of like a hibernation situation, or a way of going into stasis, or possibly something like sending robots on a ship and human embryos. I mean, we'll no doubt send robotic spacecraft outside the solar system first before we send any humans. But there are a lot of Earth-like planets in the galaxy, in the universe, too. And the eventual goal would be to settle other Earth-like planets and travel throughout. And I think that in the very long run for humans, we actually might have a kind of Star Trek future in that there will be aliens, but the aliens will all be descendants of humans who have diverged by living on different planets throughout the galaxy.
Yeah, I mean, I guess from that logic, everybody's an alien somewhere.
Like an alien in New York, like the Sting song. But then, and then it will actually be humanoid type alien. So Star Trek might not have it so wrong, but they'll all be descendants of Earth.
Yeah, we're probably going to get to the future and realize that the creators of Star Trek themselves were actually from the future, and that's how they got everything right.
Yeah. But I'm actually pretty pessimistic about interstellar travel. Throughout that chapter, I talk about all the different ways you could travel to other stars, and I think I'm actually pretty pessimistic about it. And I talk about all the ways why this wouldn't work, and then this wouldn't work, and then this wouldn't work. And the only technology that probably would work, maybe, in the near term that we know that definitely we could do, or almost definitely, is writing bombs, like nuclear bombs, fission bombs. So there was a project in the 1950s and 60s where they envisioned pushing nuclear bombs at the back of a spaceship and riding the shockwaves to another star.
Project Orion.
And that is Project Orion. And that is actually technically feasible, but politically it's definitely not feasible. So I don't think we're probably going to do that because the danger of launching miniaturized high-yield nuclear weapons into space is self-evidently hazardous. But there are other technologies that if we get them to work in the next, 30, 40, 50 years, whatever it is, like fusion power, that might provide a way to travel to another star. And then, of course, there's antimatter, which is a very good source of energy if we could ever produce it and contain it and find a way to safely use it. So, but it's sort of theoretical. And then I talk about warp drives and stuff, which currently break the laws of physics, but that doesn't mean they always will. I mean, there may be something, some kind of breakthrough that changes our understanding of the laws of physics, but I'm not holding my breath for that, but we'll see. That's why I sort of think the future is colony ships and things like that, and sort of long voyages to other stars. Yeah.
So I do have a question about why you chose to include the bit about simulations in this book, because the whole book is kind of like an optimistic picture on the future of exploration and human progress and things like that. And so I guess I'm just curious about your perspective on, like, we're definitely going to create simulations that are indistinguishable from this one. So that's not up for debate, obviously. But I'm wondering, like, what you think, why you chose to include it in here, because it almost seems like that idea, the idea of a simulation, is counterintuitive to exploration, because once we have simulations that are indistinguishable from this one, people are just going to, will there be much more exploration happening?
Well, yeah, that's actually one of my greatest fears for an apocalypse scenario, which is actually kind of a gentle, nice, warm and fuzzy apocalypse where everyone kind of decides to go into the virtual world and never emerge. And we upload ourselves into computers and get too good at entertaining ourselves to explore. That is, I don't know if that's realistic or not. I think we do have this intrinsic urge to explore, but if we can kind of fool ourselves into thinking we're exploring, is that just as good as the real thing? Or is there something, you know how in the Matrix, it didn't quite suit them and they could kind of tell, they were just like uneasy, basically. They had this uneasy mm-hmm. sense that something is not right. Is that going to be the case? Is there any reason why we would have that kind of sense? Probably not. I mean, are we just going to upload ourselves into the Matrix and live there forever? Maybe we will. So that is one possible future of humanity, and I kind of hope that's not the actual future. But it is. I think that's sort of one of the most likely scenarios for the human future in kind of a dystopian, utopian future.
So how does the idea, I guess my question is, how does the idea of simulations fit into the thesis of this anthem of yours about exploration? And, you know, it's such a positive book. It's such an optimistic book about what humans are capable of. And so obviously you kind of have to fit simulations in there because it's arguably the peak of technology. If and when we're able to create it, it would be like the peak of human progress is to basically recreate our own, you know, environment in a digital way that we can't distinguish between. So I guess it makes sense. It's not that it doesn't belong in there, but I am curious how it fits into your thesis.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's basically one of the dystopian visions I have for the future. So I talk about whether the idea of humans spreading throughout the galaxy and becoming spacefaring and having this divergence of species and cultures is really going to happen. Because I think one of the greatest dangers to that is possibly that everyone just decides to upload themselves into a simulation instead. So it doesn't, it's an alternative track that doesn't continue that progress. Probably. I mean, obviously it can be used to supplement. So you can imagine sending robotic spacecraft to another solar system and kind of really mapping out what the planets would look like. And then you could have these simulations where you travel virtually to other spacecraft or to other worlds. And you could imagine uploading yourself into a spacecraft and kind of virtually traveling through the clouds of Venus or gas giants or something like that. And so you could imagine kind of virtual exploration where you send robotic spacecraft, but somehow have your consciousness present or something like that. So it's not totally dystopian necessarily, but I kind of, maybe I'm chauvinistic in wanting even this material flesh to exist, but I think I kind of like human bodies. It seems reasonable to want to stay in a body rather than just upload yourself into a computer. So, yeah.
Yeah, but I guess
is also a very likely answer to Fermi's paradox, which is, where are the aliens? Why aren't they here? Maybe they've just uploaded themselves into a computer. So they're still on their own.
Or maybe they're in the real world and we're in a computer.
Yeah, that's possible as well. But again, what do you do with that? So I
no, you don't do anything with it. You do nothing with
exactly.
it.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. You leave that one right there. I guess what's interesting to me about the idea of simulations, especially in the context of your book, is that people kind of tend to react one of two ways to the idea of like a Matrix like simulation. They either tend to like roll their eyes right out of the gate and they're like, oh, this is just like, you know, I'm not even going to waste my time thinking about this. But these are the same people who want an Oculus Rift or an HTC Vive. Everybody wants one of those in their house, but they'll like roll their eyes that it'll ever get good enough to like be completely immersive, you know?
Yeah,
so
it's kind of strange.
That's kind of a concerning, there's a concerning disparity somewhere in there, in the logic there. It's like people are like inching towards it and they don't even realize it, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah.
The other reaction that you get is that people are like totally, and I guess this is probably where the bucket I'd fall into, is that I'm like, yeah, we're probably going to create that stuff and it's probably going to be a big problem. And I also want an HTC Vive or an Oculus Rift. So we're probably just gonna create it, and you know, our poor kids are gonna have to decide what to do with their brains.
Yep.
I have no idea how I'm gonna advise that one. I'll just be like, yeah, I hope you make a good decision.
Yeah, even today you have that problem with people becoming so immersed in their computer games that they ignore the world and suffer dire consequences. Like, I think there was the stories of, in Korea, this couple playing World of Warcraft so much that they forgot to check on their baby and the baby died or whatever it was, something like that.
I heard about this. Yeah. So insane. as we work towards wrapping this up, let's talk about the tightrope that your book walks real quick. It's interesting because you don't just talk about the successes of human progress. You also talk about the pitfalls, and you spend a decent amount of time talking about shit we've gotten wrong. I think what's great about it is that despite all the dangers of exploration and going into the unknown, there's, you know, it's generally an optimistic picture that we have. Like, looking back, like, it's done nothing but make us better and stronger. Like, the more we go into the unknown, it's like we don't have a choice but to just, you know, explore. And I think that's what's so cool about this book. So from that perspective, is there anything we didn't talk about yet that you wanted to talk about before we close?
What would aliens be like? We didn't talk about that.
The alien bit.
Yeah, I have a whole chapter talking about what aliens might look like or be like, and how probable it is that they exist, and how probable it is that intelligences exist, so extraterrestrial intelligences, and would they be like us? And I sort of build up the entire case that it's reasonable to suspect that they might be a lot like us. They might be humanoid, intelligent, omnivorous hunters with two arms and two legs and eyes at the top of their heads and all this kind of stuff. And then I break it all down and say, no, not necessarily, because they might be octopus, basically, or something like that, right?
Right.
So there are several traits that any intelligent civilization, any intelligent aliens, extraterrestrials would have. And that is that they would have the same laws of physics as us, so they would be constrained by the same constraints that we are in terms of physical laws. They would be shaped by evolution, so whatever form they took would be at least locally optimized, so be shaped. It would be shaped by their environment. And they would be collaborative because they would need to share information. They would need to communicate in some way to organize society. I think it's highly likely that they would be agricultural, because they would at least have to have some kind of surplus production of resources so they could devote some time to technological development, just as we did. The agricultural revolution is what enables us to be technologically advanced, because we can have specialists who spend their time developing technology. So that would probably be true. At least they'd have to have surplus resources. I think they might be collaborative hunters. I think that's highly likely, because they would coordinate actions. And I think above all, they would actually be explorers. And I think that's sort of the message of the book, is that exploration is one of those traits that leads to technological development, and it leads to optimization of resources, and it leads to spreading out throughout their own planet. And it leads to curiosity, which would eventually carry them to other stars. So if we met them in space, they would be basically by definition explorers.
Yeah, I guess they'd have to be. What's interesting about that is that, you know, there's a few things in there. I want to talk about the octopus distinction that you made earlier, because I think that's also really interesting. But, you know, if there are aliens, if there were, they would, you know, be bound by the same physics that we observe in space. And you know, so it's, you know, there's this idea, there's this kind of like this people think about aliens and they're like, oh, they'd be so mysterious if they existed. You know, there'd be so many questions, and there would be, but at the same time, they would be, if they exist, they would be sharing the same space that we all share. And so there would have to be, you know, we would have to be able to make certain guesses about them that could be right. Like, it's not absurd to ask questions like this,
They would have math. They would have to invent math, for example. Their math might be different. They might use a different base system. We were talking about base systems the other week. They very much might use a totally different base system or whatever, but they would have to use math in some form. They would have to have language in some form.
Mm-hmm. And I guess that leads us back to the octopuses. And what's so interesting about that, and you already know this, obviously, because you chose to write about it, but I felt like when I read the part about octopuses and how different they are, I wondered if people might skip past that part and not even really think twice. What's so interesting is that, like, how did octopuses and humans even evolve on the same planet? I mean, obviously there was, I'm sure a good evolutionary biologist could give perfectly good reasons, but it's just, we're so different. Like, even being, if an octopus and a human can evolve on the same planet bound by the same laws, then like that just, it's just bonkers. It's crazy. 'Cause the octopus has how many different brains, and it's totally decentralized. The cognition is totally one arm doesn't even know what the other one is doing. You know, it's crazy.
3 hearts and 9 brains or something like that. Yeah. So octopus are another intelligence that have evolved separately from us. Obviously, they're not quite as intelligent as us, but they can make and use tools, and they select strategies to avoid danger and to hunt prey. And octopus do this because they fulfill a similar role to us. We're generalists. Humans are generalists. Instead of having sharp teeth and claws or fast legs to run, we have a brain and we have hands to manipulate tools. And that's kind of similar with the octopus. So instead of having being optimized for one particular strategy of hunting or defense, they assess threats and decide what strategy to employ. They can hide, they can shoot ink, they can change color, they can swim away, they can take shelter. They basically assess what the threat is and decide what to do about it, which is what we do. Mm-hmm. We make decisions based on what we're facing. We don't just always react in the same way. We try to assess what the threat is or what the opportunity is and then act accordingly. So they're generalists. Octopus are generalists just like humans are.
Interesting. I wonder if that has something to do with, you know, like humans, we have the 3 general stages of brain development. There's like the reptilian one, the mammalian, and then like the part that makes us distinctly human is the neocortex. So it's like, you know, we do this same process that the octopuses do, as you're talking about, where we decide how to react to certain things. Maybe that's because we have different sections of our brain giving us different options in any scenario. And maybe the octopus is the same way. Maybe the octopus has, because they have different stages of their brain, I'd be curious to know how the octopus brain developed and what the different stages do, and if it's similar at all in the way that the human brain works together. Obviously, they wouldn't be the same brain. I'm not saying that, but that, like, you just said that octopuses kind of have a similar process of deciding how to react to things. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's because of the way our brains have developed. Like, we have all these different stages that feed us impulses that are, you know, good instincts, but like, you know, we don't behave like a reptile. Just responds the same way all the time because it has just a reptilian brain. And mammals, it gets a little more complicated because I think all mammals have a reptilian brain too, right? Because they evolved out of reptiles. So, you know, mammals, generally speaking, have like a reptilian impulse and a mammalian impulse. And if you're human, there's an extra layer there that you're dealing with in any scenario. So maybe it's the same thing with octopuses, is what I'm trying to say. Maybe they have all these different evolutionary stages of their brains that feed them instincts, and then they just react, you know, based on a decision that they have to make.
Yeah, there's definitely something to that. They have evolved over time to be generalists and to kind of make decisions. So certainly they probably had multiple phases of brain development, and they're basically related to slugs or snails, which are pretty dumb. But octopus have kind of gone beyond that to have additional decision-making layers, probably like a neocortex. But they definitely don't have the mammalian brain, and octopus are not sort of nurturing in the same way that mammals are. But they probably have something akin to neocortex development, where they make, which is more decision making than most mollusks, invertebrates.
Are they self-aware? So, are octopuses self-aware?
Well, that term is a little bit vague. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But I don't think we know. I don't think we have a way of telling exactly if they're self-aware. I mean, I think they are to a very limited degree, is probably the answer. Like, are dogs self-aware?
Well, yeah, I guess the distinction there is, aware that they have to survive, yes, aware
of their existence. I don't think they ponder their existence, like, oh, yeah, I'm going to die, and therefore, like, I need to plan for things and stuff like that. I don't think probably any animals really do that beyond humans, maybe, like, orcas or something like that, maybe chimps, but that's different from self-awareness, where are they present in the moment and can think. I think dogs probably are to that extent.
Yeah. Well, the way I could be off in this, but the way that I've always seen it is that, you know, if you're even reptiles have to be self-aware to an extent because they're super self-preserving, you know?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, to some extent, almost all animals are self-aware. Maybe not insects. It's hard to say, but to a certain extent, all complex animals are self-aware.
But the way I've seen it is that, you know, even a reptile is self-aware, but mammals have like a heightened level of self-awareness because they realize that there's like other creatures like them that they can work with to improve their survival odds. And then humans and other animals with a neocortex have like even a higher level of self-awareness because it just seems like the more layers of, you know, evolutionary development in the brain, the more awareness in general there is. And so maybe self-awareness is kind of a vague term, like you said. Maybe that's not the best way to put it, but like cognitive or something, you know, are octopuses cognitive might be a better way to say it. I don't know. Maybe they are. I mean, they can use tools, you know. Do they work together? Do octopuses collaborate?
No. See, they don't really have that part. They don't have the collaboration. I'm not aware of it. Maybe occasionally they do, but they're not communal. They're pretty independent, right? Whereas humans and other mammals tend
to be communal.
That's what I thought. And that's why they don't really have the mammalian part of the brain, kind of. But yeah, so yeah, it's not that self-aware is vague. It's that there's different levels of it, clearly, and it's sort of hard to tell what animals have what levels of it. Yeah.
Cognition seems like a better word.
No, I don't know cognition to me implies, well, I guess cognizant, so it means kind of, I think it just is almost a synonym. It means the same thing as self-aware, either that or it means something decision-making. So I think self-aware is actually a good term. It's just, it's not an on or off. It's not binary. It's not I'm self-aware or I'm not self-aware. It's to what level am I self-aware? And there's different levels of it. It's just kind of a spectrum.
To put it in terms of humans, it's almost like the reptilian part of our brain makes us aware of ourselves. The mammalian part of our brain makes us aware of other things like us that could benefit us. And the neocortex makes us aware that there's any distinction between the two.
Yeah.
Or something like that.
Something like that. I don't think it's that straightforward, but to large, I think essentially there's a lot of truth in what you're saying. Yeah.
Because and it's obviously an oversimplification, and I'm not an evolutionary biologist, but it does.
But it's true. It's largely true, I think. Yeah.
No other mammal besides humans have created civilizations, have become developed enough to, you know, to speak like we do, you know, and like create tools and technology like we have. So we have to at least guess. It seems that the development of our neocortex, the human neocortex, has something to do with the level of awareness that we have. It's gotta have something to do with it.
Yeah, and problem solving. There's no question that humans are the best problem solvers on Earth. I mean, there's basically no question that humans are the smartest creatures on Earth, except for maybe the dolphins, as in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Thanks for all the fish. But in reality, there's no question that humans are the smartest animals. And I don't think that's, unless we're so stupid we don't even realize it. You know,
just like, more likely.
That's almost like the, are we living in a simulation? Like we actually are lizards, but we're so stupid we don't realize that we're lizards, you know?
That's ridiculous. Oh, man. Well, this has been such a lovely book that you've written. I look forward to reading it again. Like I said, I'm probably going to end up, this is the kind of book that you don't read once. It's almost like a reference book or something. Like I'm sure I'll pick it up in the future if I like need to like know some random fact about something. It's like, that's what I love about it is that it's, you know, there's so many different little side jaunts and there's just so much detail in it. So I commend you. Great, great work. Is there any other books that you're thinking about in the future, or is there?
I am. Yeah, I'm thinking about a number of books, but it's probably too early to talk about them in detail. And I don't know. I mean, I certainly haven't really started writing, but I'm sort of thinking about ideas and taking notes of things and stuff like that. Yeah.
Well, we hope you guys have enjoyed this series on Beyond the Known. If you haven't checked it out, please do. There's also an audiobook. That's how I finished the book. I started reading it actually with my eyes, and then I finished it with my ears. So highly recommend it. Hope you guys have enjoyed this. If you want to follow us on Twitter, you can do that. I'm at Julian Was Here. Andrew is at Mars Raider. We do these episodes every Monday. We hope to have you back next week.
Thanks for listening.